I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Jennifer Morrill, CEO of Adiri, a company that produces baby bottles that most closely simulate breastfeeding. The company was founded by Jennifer's father, but the bottles weren't widely accepted by customers until recently. The product, called the Adiri Natural Nurser, is available nationwide in stores including The Right Start, Babies R Us, and Whole Foods. Welcome.
Thank you.
How does the Adiri bottle differ from other baby bottles on the market right now?
Well, it has a more soft texture, breast-like feel than other bottles on the market. The design of it is very unique in that it opens from the bottom. It's very simple to use. You just unscrew it from the bottom and fill it from the bottom. It's also polycarbonate-free, and there's only a few bottles on the market at the moment besides glass bottles that are polycarbonate-free, and that's become quite a big issue as there's some questionable health issues with polycarbonate plastic. There has been some science that says that the polycarbonates and bisphenol A, which is in the polycarbonate plastic, can interfere with endocrine function, which is necessary in the development of the nervous system.
One of the other differentiators is the fact that the nipple is indeed shaped like a breast.
It's shaped like a breast. The previous product that was my dad's invention was called the Breast Bottle Nurser. It was actually a half dome that was very much like a woman's breast. And it was almost self-consciously like a breast that people were embarrassed to use it. Our bottle is a little less self-consciously like a breast. It still has a dome like a breast and a standard baby bottle nipple. And it also is made of this very, very soft plastic. So it actually feels, when it's filled with warm milk, it does feel like a breast.
Now, you talk about the earlier product really looking even more like a breast, which made people uncomfortable. Were men more uncomfortable by the shape than women?
It was both. It was so different than anything on the market, so different from a conventional baby bottle that there was that high acceptance curve to begin with. That just, do I want to use something that's so wildly different than everything else I see on the shelves? Then, of course, there was, with both women and men, this feeling of not really wanting to hold which would look like a breast.
Right. Now, you're not the founder of the company. You're the CEO. Your father founded the company. Where does the name of the company, Adiri, come from?
My father had a lot of different ways of looking at the world. And one of the things that he wanted to do was to bring together different symbology in his life. And so the name Adiri pulls together different parts of women's names that he had loved in his life. The other thing was he was a savvy businessman and he wanted to be at the top of search engines. And he knew that to be at the top of the search engines at the time, you needed to have an A word, sort of like AAA locksmith.
What did your father do in his life?
Well, he started out his career as in hotel and restaurant development.
And then how did he transition to become an inventor?
Well, he was always mechanically oriented. He was a mechanic in high school, an auto mechanic. He always created things. There's lots of stories that his friends will tell from high school about how he would, you know, make a motorized vehicle when everybody else was just learning to fix their bike. And then he also was an artist throughout his life. He did pottery. He had a stained glass business even when he was an executive. He made stained glass weather vanes in the shape of a monarch butterfly, and he sold them through the Horchow catalog and major catalogs. And he eventually left the executive world just to be an artist and an inventor.
What are some of the other inventions that he created other than the bottle?
He had a number of inventions that had to do with environmentally progressive technologies, like wind generators and new engines. So he was very interested in furthering environmental causes. He also invented a whimsical musical fountain. This fountain was such that it had various tubes, and when the water hit the tubes, they would play different notes.
Despite all these different inventions, really his favorite or his baby was this bottle.
Well, I think that he felt that the bottle was the most commercially viable.
What were you doing at the time while your father was trying to get this bottle company off the ground?
Well, I was living a very conventional life. I went to law school. I became a lawyer, and I had a very 9-to-5 existence, stocking away money in my savings account. And although he tried on a number of occasions to interest me in working with him on the business, I was not geared that way. It was not something I wanted to do.
You were a lawyer at Yahoo for a few years. And what was the catalyst for your saying, okay, you know what, I do want to make this transition?
Well, in the early spring of 2005, my father died. And it was actually a very difficult time for me. I had a 2-month-old. And so I was in that difficult period where you're thinking about going back to work. And you know that it's going to be a huge transition from your maternity leave to full-time work. And so I was gearing up for that. I had a 2-year-old as well. And then my father dies suddenly, and it was actually a suicide. So it was a very traumatic death for me. And I had his business that I inherited. I was the executrix of his estate. And I was forced to learn this business. And really through that whole process and realizing I could get through all of that, I'm like, you know, I probably can run this business.
Now, obviously, people have a lot of reasons for killing themselves. What part of his reasoning do you think was connected with this business?
In some respects, he was very pessimistic. He thought we were going to have a nuclear war way back when. And he was also extremely optimistic. And when he invented this product in the 90s, he thought he was going to be a multimillionaire. And he put his heart, his soul, all his money into the company. And all he did was lose money. And he, you know, left this world with having made no money off of the company. It actually owes him money at this point, the estate money. And yeah, so.
And to what extent did your wanting to pick this up, pick the pieces up, what part of that desire came from a sense of responsibility versus a sense of, you know what, I think this is a viable company and I think I could really create something valuable here?
Well, there was a huge sense of responsibility. I remember looking through his emails. I had saved all of his emails. Mm-hmm. And I was also looking through emails that he had written to a guy he was working with at the time. And one of the things he said to this guy was, you know, my daughter has a friend who's interested in buying the business. This was a couple of years before he died. I really want you to get them everything they need because my dream is to have my daughter take over the business. Mm-hmm. And when I read that, I felt an incredible sadness, of course, that it had never happened in his lifetime, but also a major responsibility. But quite honestly, I couldn't sell the business. I tried. So I was stuck with it. And I, you know, that combined with the fact that I started talking with this fantastic industrial designer, Whipsaw, and they were so excited about the project. And really, I started to see the potential here. And I was like, you know what? This is something that might take off. And I want to be a part of it.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jennifer Morrill, CEO of Adiri, a company that produces baby bottles that most closely simulate breastfeeding. So you decide, okay, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to leave my stable job at Yahoo and get this off the ground. How did that happen logistically? Did you work on this part-time while you were still at Yahoo, or what was that early day situation like?
Well, it was a crazy time. I had an amazing boss. So they let me do this crazy life of trying to sell the business while I was working as a lawyer for Yahoo. I worked a 4-day schedule and I would do things like fly to trade shows. And I shared a booth with this other company and they kept saying, why aren't you selling the product? Get out there. Get out there and sell. They were standing in the aisles with their product. And so I said, you know, I'm just not a salesperson, and plus this is a ridiculous looking product. It looks like a breast. And so they took it and they went out to the aisles and they're trying to sell it. And then they came back and said, you know, don't quit your day job. And there was that. And then there was the conference calls in my office trying to, you know, keep the doors closed so nobody would know I was actually talking to a baby products company and not, an internet company. It was difficult. But then eventually, after a year of that, I just was like, you know, I'm ready.
Now, in the meantime, you have two small children at home and a husband. How did they feel about it, or at least your husband feel about your leaving this job that was providing some stable income and going to a entrepreneurial endeavor where you're making zero right now?
Well, at the risk of sounding ingenuine, my husband is really, he's so supportive. And when I told him, you know, I'm about to go into a job where I will have no money for, you know, no salary coming in, and it could totally tank, and I might be even more stressed out than I am now. And he said, go for it. He also had a lot of faith in the design, in the redesign.
No. So what did you do from there? You said you spoke to a design firm. What did they do to change the product?
Well, we talked with this design firm, Whipsaw, and they are mostly do electronics, consumer electronics. And so they were very excited about taking on something completely different. First of all, they're very much into imitating nature to the extent possible, which my dad was also into. He said, if nature is the best inventor, and you would do well to imitate nature. Then me and my business partners went and we talked to hundreds of mothers and said, what do you want to see in this product? And that was the most important thing. And we would take that back to Whipsaw. They showed us 10, 20 designs. Together, Whipsaw and the team of us who were mothers and had talked to mothers came up with this design that's won multiple awards and is, you know, being carried by major chains now.
It seems like you fell into an entrepreneurial role accidentally to some extent, and you became the CEO after you had been a lawyer for many years. Talk to me a little bit about that dynamic.
Well, as a lawyer, I was always trying to present the side of caution, like, okay, this is what could happen if we don't put this clause into the agreement. And the business person would always say, in a million years, that might happen. And I would always say, yes, but my job is to cover that in a million years. And so we'd have that back and forth. When I suddenly switched over, I found myself doing deals on a handshake. I mean, I have a lot of partners that I work with now, major partners, like our manufacturer, who we don't have a written agreement with. So when you're actually out in the real world and I am that business person on the other side of the table from me when I was at Yahoo saying, this is ridiculous. And fortunately, I don't have an obligation to a large corporation to, you know, I do have an obligation to the shareholders, but I do feel like I'm acting in their best interest.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jennifer Morrill, CEO of Adiri, a company that produces baby bottles that most closely simulate breastfeeding. We'll hear more from Jennifer coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Jennifer Morrill, CEO of Adiri, a company that produces baby bottles that most closely simulate breastfeeding. The company was founded by Jennifer's father, but the bottles weren't widely accepted by customers until recently. The product, called the Adiri Natural Nurser, is available nationwide in stores including The Right Start, Babies R Us, and Whole Foods. How did people receive you now that you were the CEO and an accidental entrepreneur, not having had a past in getting companies off the ground?
Well, at first, I was very self-deprecating, and that in some respects served me well because a lot of people were willing to go the extra effort to help me. My father had recently killed himself. I had inherited this business, and people were amazingly generous with their time and resources. I got discounted services. And I was genuinely, every self-deprecating thing I said was honest. I genuinely had no idea what I was doing. However, over time, that didn't serve me well. And I started to realize that that I was doing myself a disservice by presenting myself to the world as a complete novice. And so when we did get the Babies R Us deal, I was telling a woman that I'd actually asked to be my business partner early on, but she felt like it wasn't the right move for her at the time, given their financial situation and other reasons. And she said, wow, Babies R Us, soon you'll need a real CEO. And at the time, I remember thinking, maybe she's right. And then I was like, you know what? What is a real CEO? I am doing fine, and I have a vision, and I started to realize that I really needed to own that and not talk myself down. This, another example of that is when we went to get our round of funding valuation, and we went to the valuator and we gave him sales forecasts that we had very carefully come up with throughout the world, and we had looked at populations and other bottle sales, and we had really spent a lot of time on our forecasts. And he said, you know, these are wildly optimistic. I can't do a valuation based on these because I really don't think they're right. And we said, well, we do think they're right. And he said, well, you know, why don't you just go with half? He's like, even if you did half of these sales, it would be pretty good for three moms in a kitchen. And yeah. And it was another one of those, huh, is he really saying that from a sexist point of view, or have I just been talking us up as three moms in a kitchen? You know, which is it? Mm-hmm. Have I been presenting that to the world? And at some point, you have to stop slamming yourself, and you just have to say, you know, I have a vision. I have a great product. After 2 years of really just amazing challenges and setbacks and just plowing on, eventually you just have to say, I must be doing something right.
Now, you mentioned that you don't have a natural sales personality, and you're not naturally an entrepreneur. How did you go about finding partners for this? You work with two other women. How did you find them?
Well, I asked around. I talked to friends of mine and told them that I was about to embark on running this company. And did they know anybody that was willing to work for nothing, spend time away from their kids, possibly pay money for childcare, and was willing to work on this product, which at the time a lot of people were laughing about, the breast bottle, and making that into something completely new. And so I really just interviewed one person, and we had a connection, and she seemed very solid, and she came highly recommended, and Beth Shavodian. She and I embarked on this thing together, and it was we would laugh how much like a junior achievement in high school it was like. We would just sit there in our office and laugh. She'd be sitting there on a typewriter that we looked all over town to find, doing the stock certificates. And then we found our other business partner, Sarah Eisner. She was a photographer. And after the photo shoot, she came up to us and said, you know, I'd really love to work with you guys. Do you have a job opening? And we explained to her, the only job openings we have are unpaid. You'll have to pay for childcare, et cetera, et cetera. And so she decided that wasn't for her immediately. And she consulted with us for 2 months. And then we asked her again, mm-hmm. How about coming aboard for no money? And she said yes, because it was looking promising.
So it's you and your partner, and you're sitting in this office now in the San Francisco area where you guys are based. Walk me through a day in the life.
Well, we share, at the time when we started, we shared an office, a garage. It was actually a garage with two other internet startups. And they were valid startups, Silicon Valley startups with venture capital. One's actually been bought by a Johnson & Johnson company, Baby Center, since then. Yeah. And they would often bring in these venture capitalists and, you know, big names in the Silicon Valley. And even though they always take pains to introduce us, there was always sort of that sense of, hey, make a bottle, you know, don't mind them. And we had the bottles out on our desk, and it was sort of like the office joke. But yeah, we would sit at our little grouping of desks that were pushed together and just laugh about how we were going about doing simple things like our letterhead, for example. We actually did our letterhead. We had an 800 number that my father actually had originally purchased and put on all of the literature. And we got 3,000 sheets of letterhead. And then we went to a trade show with our price list on this letterhead. And one of the potential customers came up to us and said, you know, I tried calling your 800 line because I wanted to place an order. And I'll just place an order in person because, you know, you might want to check your 800 line. It's not very nice. And we said, really? What is it? And she said, well, I might have called the wrong number, but it's a porn line. Oh. And so we were horrified, and we got the cell phone out. We called the number, and sure enough, and this is on 3,000 sheets of letterhead, our price list that was at this major industry show, it was a porn line because we actually have an 888 number, and I had put 1-800. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing that is very embarrassing, especially when you're at a trade show with big companies like Playtex and one of their salespeople came over and said, "You're the company with the porn line." And that's how we, you know, here we have a bottle that looks like a breast, and we've got a porn line on our letterhead. And it was just very hard to be taken seriously at the get-go.
Well, I guess it taught you to pay attention to details.
Yes, we've gotten better at that.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jennifer Morrill, CEO of Adiri, a company that produces baby bottles that most closely simulate breastfeeding. So you built your team, you changed the design of the bottle. Were there any interesting or crucial inflection points for you? Was there a certain set of customers that became really enthusiastic about the product that helped to get you guys to the next level?
Well, I knew we really had something when we started to send out pictures of the prototype, and we took it to a few trade shows, including American Academy of Pediatrics and another big trade fair for our industry. And people would come up and say, "Bravo." You know, it had the wow factor. And the wow factor is something I'd always aspired to with this bottle.
Was there a retailer that accepted the product that helped to launch sales?
Well, I was at a trade show, and it was the third day of the trade show, and things were really winding down. It was very quiet on the floor. And I was giving my sales pitch to a couple women at the booth, and I just asked them where they were from, and I looked on the badge, and it was the Babies R Us buyer. Really, that was the moment when they said, "We came to you because we'd heard about you." I'm like, maybe we have something here.
And juxtaposed with that feeling, what's an example of a dark time that you felt like, maybe I shouldn't be pursuing this, or, wow, this is kind of tough? Just as an example of...
That is funny, because... I think the ratio of dark days to good days is probably pretty high. We've had a lot of setbacks and glitches. Originally, we wanted to make the bottle two pieces. It was very important to us to have it be extremely simple. A lot of bottles on the market have lots of parts that are easy to lose. And if you try to assemble it in the middle of the night, it can be very frustrating. And at some point, we realized there's no way to do this as a two-piece bottle. The valve part of the bottle just, it wasn't working out in terms of the design to have it be one piece.
By the way, when you say valve, this is on the bottom of the bottle, and it neutralizes the pressure so that the child doesn't ingest air when he or she is imbibing.
That's right. And we really wanted to have a valve that did reduce colic and that did a good job equalizing pressure. Also, because the material of the nipple is very soft, you need something to reinflate it as the child is drinking so that it doesn't collapse. So we decided after a lot of going back and forth that we were not going to be able to do a one-piece cap and valve. And that was a dark moment for us because we had been selling it as a two-piece bottle. We had already told everybody our release date, and we were way past it. And it was just one of those things where we're never going to figure this out. And that was the general feeling at the time.
But you ultimately did figure out
that. We did. Mm-hmm. Everything can be figured out. And that's one thing I've learned, and it's been the most valuable lesson, is that you may not win every challenge, but you can always find some sort of solution. It may not be the one that you wanted. It may not be a 100% win, but there's always a way to jump any hurdle.
And how often are you interfacing with mothers? I heard that you make home deliveries or that you go to mothers' homes. What is that?
Yeah, we talk to moms 3-4 times a day. Just a couple weeks ago, I had one mother call me, and she had a problem with one of our bottles. Something was wrong with the flow of the bottle, and she was desperate. She had a baby that would not take any other bottle, and it turned out that she didn't live far from me. And so that was a time that we had a really bad storm in California, and most of the area was blacked out. Power was out all over the place. And I said, "Well, you know, I could bring you the bottle. I know that you may not want me to because privacy concerns and the storm and, you know, all that." And she said, no, come down. Come to my house." Mm-hmm. So I came to her house. She came to the door with a flashlight and a baby in her arms. And I had my daughter in the driveway in the car. And, you know, I handed her the goods. And it was sort of like a, you know, an underworld transaction. And then I got back in the car and explained to my daughter what we had just done. But yeah, that happens a lot. I definitely feel like I know a lot of new moms in the world.
Maybe that's a blessing, not having too much capital, because you then have to do everything yourself and be resourceful and have this customer interaction that you might not have if you had a customer service department.
Yes, it's a blessing and a curse. There, at some point, you realize that being a generalist is not serving you well, and that you really do need to get some expertise in certain areas. Mm-hmm. We're starting to reach that point where we really do need a dedicated customer service department. We really do need a dedicated accountant. We are starting to need these people on staff. And so we're having to make that difficult decision. How much capital do we need to bring in to really grow this business?
Right. Now, where is the capital coming from at this point?
Right now, all of the shareholders are family members and friends. And we have a few outside folks, but no large investors.
How quickly are your sales growing at this point?
They would be growing a lot faster if we had the inventory. We have right now 10,000 back orders. We are getting reorders from big stores like Whole Foods and Right Start on a regular basis. But it's very hard for us right now to fill those orders given inventory issues and manufacturing issues.
What are some of those issues?
We had a big shipment come in few weeks ago that was about 15,000 bottles, and we were really counting on that shipment to fill a bunch of orders. And we shipped out some of them and started to get calls that the flows were too fast. The milk was pouring out into the baby's mouth. And whenever we get a call like that, we immediately replace the bottle. And it was starting to get to the point where, you know, something's wrong with a shipment. So we started to QA each one here in the U.S. to see what was going on. And there was...
You started to what?
A quality test. So we basically, with 15,000 bottles, filled each one up with water and held it up to see how it flowed and then put it out to dry. Very, very, very frustrating. You know, we realized that a lot of the shipment was problematic. And we are now moving to a different way of drilling the hole so that it's more consistent. Mm-hmm. But that was a major setback.
How resolute are you about just seeing this through?
There are days when I joke with my husband, you know, that whoever will offer me $5,000 for the company, it's sold. But, you know, realistically, I mean, I never got to go on the radio at Yahoo. I never got to go. Last week we were giving bottles out to Denise Richards, Tori Spelling, big celebrities at a celebrity baby gift giveaway. You know, that's the kind of thing I never got to do before. It is mostly a huge adventure, and of course I'm going to keep going with it. It's been amazing to me, the press engine. You get one press mention, somebody else picks it up, and then it kind of has a life of its own. Mm-hmm. We were recently in the New York Times, and that generated all sorts of interesting opportunities from a media standpoint.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jennifer Morrill, CEO of Adiri, a company that produces baby bottles that most closely simulate breastfeeding. The company was founded by Jennifer's father, but the bottles weren't widely accepted by customers until recently. The product, called the Adiri Natural Nurser, is available nationwide in stores including The Right Start, Babies R Us, and Whole Foods. Now, you are a mom of two, as you mentioned before. Did you ever use the bottle, or did you ever feel like you needed to use the bottle for your kids?
My kids, I breastfed my kids, and when I went back to work, I was lucky. They took a bottle very easily. I just was a stressed out working mother, and the product had to be easy. It had to be very straightforward. So I found my father's product, the breast bottle, just too time consuming. There was too high of a learning curve. Sometimes it wouldn't necessarily screw together right. Sometimes it leaked. And so I did use it when my father was in town. I did use it when he called me on the phone and told me I needed to use it. And I did use it just on occasion when I had the patience. But for the most part, I used other bottles.
Because the bottle that your dad had created, the first prototype, was very clunky and difficult to use to some extent.
Very engineering. It was not that attractive. It had the threads of the screw top where you had to line them up just right.
Did you try to give him feedback?
Yes. My father had two strikes against him in terms of success. And one was that he didn't have the capital to really do a redesign, even if he wanted to. The second one is that he was very sure he knew what his customers, what was best for his customer, even if they didn't know, despite him not even having been around at all when we were kids, because he was on the road a lot. I gave him feedback from mothers groups. I would take his product around and show people and try to get them interested. And even though I wasn't using it myself, but I did take the product around as a dutiful daughter, and I would get feedback. And for example, at one mother's group, they said, it would be really neat if it came in different colors, you know, if it just didn't look so breast-like and it came in different colors. So I told my dad that, and he went ballistic. He said, are you kidding? This is a serious medical product. And at the time, it was widely carried by hospital lactation centers. It definitely served an important medical use. And I could see his point, but these mothers wanted something that looked good. And that wasn't something he was willing to hear.
How do you think your father would feel now if he could see what you've established, even in the changes that you've made, but the success that you're having?
Well, he'd be extremely happy and pleased. He would also have a few things to tell me about how to change the product or, you know, things that I wasn't doing quite right. He always had his 2 cents about how to run things.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Jennifer Morrill, CEO of Adiri. Coming up, we'll meet Pat Helding, founder of Fat Witch Brownie. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.
Deep greens and blues for the colors I choose. Won't you let me go down my dreams? Oh, rock by my sweet baby James.
I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Pat Helding, founder of Fat Witch Bakery, a company that sells brownies and other sweet treats, my pretty. They ship their brownies across the country and have a retail shop in Chelsea Market in Manhattan. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica.
You were a trader on the American Stock Exchange prior to starting Fat Witch. How did you decide to switch jobs and start a brownie bakery?
I really wanted to do something on my own. I don't think I can pinpoint it exactly, except that sort of building feeling that one has of, you know, I want more satisfaction out of my career. And based on that, I also went through some personal tragedy, and I thought, you know, you only have one life. Go do what you want to do.
Mm-hmm. How long were you working on the stock exchange?
Over 10 years.
Were you baking brownies for your colleagues, or were brownies in the picture at all?
They certainly were. I was baking for colleagues and bringing them in, and that's where the germ of the seed of the idea came for the business, because people would say, oh, you know those brownies you bake? I want to buy some. I'm having a party.
And where did you get the recipe from?
It was my mother's recipe.
How did you come to that decision ultimately to actually go through the process of leaving work and starting this bakery?
I was baking with somebody whose father had a bagel factory. And so we would use the bagel ovens, which are very different than a regular convection oven because they are almost like a Ferris wheel. They turn around and around. But we did a huge order for Goldman Sachs for Christmas one year, for the holiday season one year. And then I thought, you know, this is a go.
And how did you get Goldman Sachs as a customer that year?
Because I knew some people from Goldman.
Where did you go from there?
I sent out 8 postcards to friends. I drew them and sent them out and said, I'm selling brownies. And that 8 postcards. And what I did do is keep diligent lists and, you know, get it on a computer, get it into a database, and vary every single person who we sent to. And it's now probably a quarter of a million database people.
How did you come up with the witch theme?
I had a from trading, and as you might know, trading floors, one stands very close to someone else, and it's a lot of bumping and this and that. And I had a friend who had a laugh like just like a witch. You know? And one day she said, oh, I'm pregnant. And I said, oh, now I'll be standing next to a fat witch. And I just thought it was a funny name. I put it on the brownies. And we're not going to lie. They are fattening. We do use butter.
Part of the success, to me, in Fat Witch is the packaging and the whimsical artwork. Did you draw the logo?
Yes, I did. Packaging for anything, even if it's a consulting business, is very important. And I wanted each brownie to be the sense of you're getting a gift within a gift. And because most of our mothers bake brownies, I wanted something childlike in the drawing, in the logo.
Has the witch in the logo come alive to you? Like, do you look at her as kind of personified, or is it just, you know, this inhuman piece of art?
Oh, absolutely come alive. I mean, sometimes when I see 500 brownies lined up, it's almost like each one is moving, or, you know, they're a little bit different.
From 91 to 98, you were only known to Goldman Sachs and to your friends and family. Were you making enough to sustain yourself? Was this business break-even at this point or profitable?
It was barely break-even. You know, I had some savings, and that's what I was using.
How much capital did you put into the business personally when you were starting
personally,
it?
Personally, about $25,000.
And how long did it take to finally reach some type of profitability where, okay, yeah, I could make a living doing this?
It probably took about 6 or 7 years. But, I mean, you know, I was getting some income. So it wasn't a money losing, but we weren't really, you know, we were barely eking by. I mean, when I first started, I thought if I could just get an order every day, it would be so amazing. Then I could, it would be okay. We'll go forward. And that was like one order every day of the month.
How much was one order?
You know, it'd be like $30 or something.
And how much would it cost you to make that order and package it and sell it?
Well, you know, about $10.
So you're making $20 a day and you'd be happy.
Well, it wasn't a matter of being happy. I thought we could survive. We can build on this.
And do you have any children or anybody else to support financially?
No, I don't.
Was there any bank loan or anything in the process?
No. I mean, and you know, interesting that you bring it up, because when we were building out, one of the things we couldn't get was a bank loan. So without debt, you can't prove that you can take on debt.
What would banks say to you?
No, you know, you can't prove that you can grow. If your business has some debt and you have a track record of paying it back, you're actually in better shape than having no track record.
Were there times when you were thinking of leaving the business or doing something new?
Oddly enough, no. I mean, there were low moments, certainly, but I was determined to make this work.
When you say there were low moments, what do you mean by that?
I would say the lowest moment, you know, mentally was a rainy day in Manhattan. And to back up a little, we used to hand deliver things to businesses, and our delivery person did not show up. So in this pouring rain, I said, well, I'm going to have to go do this. And I had put on an old pair of running shoes that were just half falling apart, get to the place, drop it off. Blessedly, I didn't know anybody from this firm. You know, it's a Wall Street firm. I thought, if I bump into someone, die. But I didn't. Dropped it off. And as I was walking out, the sole of my shoe fell off. You know, I thought, this is just a low moment. Why am I doing this?
Now, I would think that it's kind of an isolating process. Did you miss any kind of socialization? Because you went from the floor of the American Stock Exchange, where you were in this throng of traders every day, and then you're just you.
That's a really good question. You know, yes, there was moments of feeling alone. Mm-hmm. And alone on decision making. But I think I was always meeting people and always interacting with people that I didn't feel the pinch of worse. I think someone who's doing a consulting business at home, you know, might say, I just got to get out and go to a coffee shop so I can see other people. I never had that.
And then in 1998, you found your retail space in Chelsea Market. How did you go about finding that spot? Because Chelsea Market is kind of this popular location in New York City where there are a lot of artisanal bakeries selling their their brownies or their cookies or their wine or their fresh vegetables and produce. How did you come to land in that spot?
I happened to walk by it. I had been doing a lot of work and literally walking and pounding the pavement, trying to find space. I came across it and I thought, this is it. And I begged.
I begged
because they didn't have space at the time. And I said, when the next space that opens up, let me move in.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Pat Helding, founder of Fat Witch Bakery, a mail order company that bakes and ships brownies called Witches across the country. Pat also sells a book on her website called Hannah's Homework, an entrepreneurial story for little women. Were there any lucky moments in the early days that helped accelerate the business?
One thing we've always been lucky with is publicity. I have a whole file drawer of all the publicity we've gotten. So we're always sending out media kits and building on. So I think the lucky moments are getting on, you know, Oprah's Best Things list and CNN. And, of course, this radio show would be the top.
Oh, so charming, Pat. I've heard that Japanese tourists love Fat Witch Bakery. I've heard stories that there are busloads of Japanese tourists who come and take pictures and buy Fat Witch brownies. Is that true?
Yes, it is. We have up in the bakery in Chelsea a sign in Japanese characters with a witch in a kimono.
And how did they come to know about Fat Witch Bakery?
This I don't have the answer for, but they come in droves. I mean, I know why they keep coming, and it's word of mouth, and we do get in a lot of Japanese publications and have been on Japanese TV. It's packaged very much in a way that the Japanese can understand. It's a little package, and our Fat Witch babies are the size that they're used to. It's a small thing.
And how about the taste of the brownies for Japanese people? I mean, I know in some Asian cultures, sweets are not as popular as they are in the United States. How does their palate respond to the brownies?
And in terms of the taste, chocolate is certainly a new thing to Asia, but making huge headways. In Japan, there is something called obligatory chocolate, where people give each other chocolate. I do fear that on shelves everywhere in Japan are little Fat Witch brownies, you know, just sitting there, and that people haven't eaten them because they've bought them for the packaging and the logo.
So they keep it on maybe their fireplace mantle in their living room as a piece of art, maybe.
Maybe.
Your brownies are wrapped like little presents. You know, you have them perfectly folded and with the sticker on top. Are those done by hand?
Right now they're done by hand. What I found very hard personally was trying to become more automatic and having engineers. It took me 4 years to find one. And I was not going to give up. I was not going to wrap these brownies the way everybody else did. In a sleeve, you know, everyone said, oh, no, that's the only way you can do it. And I said, but we're doing it by hand with a diamond fold because it looks like a gift. And I thought, I want to meet my grandfather, who was a mechanical engineer back in, you know, the 1880s, 1900, 1910. And I met a man from Romania who's an American citizen. You know, now he does all kinds of stuff for big companies. And he took us on. And we have in Harlem, we'll have a computerized cutting thing.
You are now building an 8,000 square foot facility in Harlem in New York City. How come?
We need more production space. We turn down business all the time. We have a waiting list of wholesale clients that want us.
And why in Harlem? I would think that Manhattan is more expensive than going to some of the outer boroughs like Queens or the Bronx. How did you happen upon this space in Harlem?
Certainly the city wants all manufacturing to be in the South Bronx and Long Island City. This was sheer luck to some degree. You know, I say it was luck, but the reality is I really pounded the pavement, you know, looking at lots. And this happened to be someone putting up a building that needed light manufacturing, and we happened to walk in at the right moment.
You sell a book on your website called Hannah's Homework, which is a book for little women to teach them about entrepreneurship. And the book is done in the style of a composition notebook that some of us remember when we were younger. It doesn't have the black marble on the cover, but it does have sort of that canvas linen material going down the spine on the side. How did you come to write this book?
I wrote it because I feel passionate that we need to be encouraging people, and especially girls, about the possibilities of having an option of being an entrepreneur and being in business and being in business for yourself. And that there's a great deal of satisfaction that one can have of creating your own business.
The central theme of the book is there's this witch named Hannah who is in elementary school, and she doesn't want to do her homework. She wants things to come more easily for her. The book's message is, no, it requires a lot of hard work and no shortcuts. Do you
exactly. You just nailed it.
Do you feel that you had any shortcuts in your work, in your experience opening this bakery?
I think
an autobiography?
No, it's not an autobiography. I certainly like to draw, you know, Hannah's passion is drawing and doing artwork. And she, like many people, not just kids, think, oh, you just get lucky when you have a business, or I'll just get lucky on this homework assignment. And it rarely happens. It's usually doing the work and the research to build a foundation.
I love there's a cat named Patience who sleeps on the gargoyle outside the window. Where'd you come up with the name Patience for the cat?
There's a lot of words in the book that are words, they're clues, they're thoughts that you need when you're running a business, and patience is one of them.
On your website, fatwitch.com, you have vintage photos by H.W. Helding. Who is H.W. Helding?
Was my father, and part of my inheritance was just boxes and boxes of photographs that he had taken from when he was young all through his life.
They are beautiful photographs. Have you done anything with those photographs commercially?
No, I haven't. I've had people ask to buy them. And then he, when he was young, I think his first camera, he happened to be in New York. And you know, took some of these pictures from just a different era. It's just a wide variety, mainly of people.
Strangers?
Yeah.
And there's a sense of nostalgia about those photos. And certainly, you know, brownies have a sense of nostalgia as well.
Absolutely. And I wanted to connect. Wanted those photographs that are on the website are of New York City. And so I want to establish that we're a New York brownie. I think New Yorkers are pretty sophisticated. And if we can make it here, we can make it anywhere. So using those photographs was a sort of a throwback to both things, nostalgia and New York.
Speaking of nostalgia, do you remember ever being in your mother's kitchen while she was baking, whether it was the brownies or cooking some dinner?
Absolutely. All the time. It's a very fond memory of, you know, something warm coming out of the oven. Chocolate chip cookies. My mother made a great chocolate chip cookie, which I have to redo the recipe at some point with Fat Witch Bakery. Because she would put, being Danish, she would put coffee in the cookies. And I mean, when my mother died, people were calling me for about a year saying, you know, what made your mother's cookie so good? I said, the coffee.
Now, your brownies have 30% more chocolate than other traditional brownies.
Absolutely.
Deeper chocolates?
Yeah, we use a 71% bittersweet chocolate, which is a pretty high chocolate content. I think it's almost as high as you can go. Chocolate without sugar is almost impossible to eat.
It becomes homework.
Right. There you go.
You've been doing this for so many years, since 1991. Do you still have those initial satisfying moments?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that's incredibly satisfying is when people walk in the bakery in Chelsea Market and they ask for witches. They're not asking for brownies. And I kind of step back and I say, I'll take 3 caramel witches and 2... walnut witches. And I say to myself, I made this up. You know? And it's just, it's a thrill. I would say most people are very generous with their praise and their thoughts. And it's a pleasure.
I think the public is also gracious and in a good mood when, because they're buying brownies, they're not buying insurance.
That could be. It's about a quality product with a sense of humor.
How many brownies are you baking per day?
At least 1,000 per day, usually around 2,000. In busy seasons, you know, 10 to 20,000.
What do you think of the Duncan Hines or Betty Crocker brownies that are sold in supermarkets?
I think it's a solution. You know, if you've got a bake sale, that's certainly a solution.
Do you like the taste of those?
No, because they're filled with chemicals.
I love
lots
them.
Okay. Would you serve it as a dessert at a dinner party?
Well, now that you're making me feel guilty, I probably wouldn't.
Okay, good.
Well, thank you very much, my pretty, for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Pat Helding, the founder of Fat Witch Bakery. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.